accession number 22636, Wheel 4.
Captain Wright, Wheel 4. You're saying that you're in a wing?
Yes, I think there were about three subalterns, and the wing commander was a major, a chap called Tartaris, I don't know, great wag. And I think we shared, between the three subalterns, supervision of all the, I think they were called parties, to be of recruits. And an unforgettable thing was attending this parade, and the parade was brought to attention, and then the Subedar, who was a viceroy commissioned officer, would march up and stamp his feet in front and announce which parties were on parade and the number of people. And of course we were saddled then with learning the language. And I can remember the extraordinary messages which came. If you had a party which became hyphenated with the next one, then you'd have two lots of these numerals. And I can remember this magnificent Subedar coming up to report Atasi Pachasi Palti Sab Ek Admi Nehai, between in the 84th and 85th party, one man missing, or whatever, you see. And the whole thing, they were wonderful at drill, they were terrific, and the whole thing was marvellously picturesque, great people. This fella had a medal, which was a rarity there, and I was curious about this, and I didn't ask him, but I might have done, but I can remember asking the wing commander, Major Charteris, and he said, oh yes, that's a MacGregor medal. And I inquired what he got it for, and he said, oh, I don't know, wrapping a sheet round himself and going over the northwest frontier border, I expect. And it was after a intelligence officer, I suppose you'd call him, of great seniority, about a turn of the century, called MacGregor. And this was awarded to people with great performance in intelligence gathering. But he was a wonderful chap, he really was. Dear old, what was his name again? Abdul Ghaffour, you see, I can remember now.
Abdul Ghaffour. That would be a Muslim name, presumably.
Yes, yes. But they were all mixed up, because the Bengal sappers recruited Sikhs, Gawalis, and Punjabi Musliman.
Would they serve in the same subunits, or would they be distinguished?
I think they were all trained together, and then when they joined an active unit, they were subdivided into a religious group, because there were three sections in each company, and they'd go accordingly.
How did you learn the language? What arranged?
I had a Munshi who, courtesy of the Indian Army, it turned up at my bungalow and taught me. And I think for more mercenary reasons than anything else, I mean, while I was playing polo and doing everything else, I managed to take the higher grade, which included writing it in Arabic script, or it was called Persi Arabic script, that's right, yes. Which served me very well later on, because when I went to Malaya and had to learn Malay, that is written in the same. So I have a stepson who took Oriental studies at Oxford and later at Princeton, and he speaks faultless Arabic. But I can't understand it. But if he writes anything, I can read it. So it's useful.
What was your work day to day in supervising the training of these soldiers?
Well, it was largely done, mainly because of the language difficulty, I suppose, by NCOs and by VCOs. But NCOs, rarely, and then the VCO was a Viceroy Commissioner, would be the intermediary, really. And but they, actually, none of them spoke English at all, so we had to pull our socks up a bit. But, they'd shoot on the range, they'd drill. I think they did their field works at a separate unit, I rather forget.
Was this then just the basic introductory training?
That's right,
being
recruit
a soldier.
Training, yeah. Yes.
How did it compare to what you had done when you'd done recruit training?
I suppose it was pretty well the same. I don't think they were yelled at so much as we were. No, I think they did the same. Musketry, field craft, drill, of course. What else? There must have been something else. Yes.
Presumably they'd have to be given physical training as well, and perhaps
marching. I believe so. I can't remember that very well, yes. I think I can have...
Do you know how long that basic training took at Torquay?
I think it was about 6 weeks.
What happened to the Indian recruit after he'd been given his 6 weeks at Torquay?
What would have happened to
him next, the Indian recruit, the soldier?
I see. It's awful that I can't... I presume he was posted to an active unit. Yes.
So you've got a constant series of batches of recruits going through.
Yes.
Could you get to know them as individuals while they were going through that system?
Frankly, no. There were so many. I mean, the expansion rate of the Indian Army was probably greater than anything similar in history, I think. I think it expanded to six times its previous thing, which is enormous.
What sort of chaps were recruited into the army? Where did they come from?
Ah, well, in Gowal, which is to the west of Nepal, there were specific castes and subcastes and all these funny things which were preferred. And so the recruiting teams didn't go beyond those areas. Most of mine came from Almora. Or Missouri, round about there. They all come up in a wonderful book. Did you ever read the Man-Eaters of Kumau? By a chap called... I can't figure it now. Wonderful book, really wonderful. And it goes through that part of the world in a lovely way. It's like a tour of a country. The Sikhs came mainly from Ambala and the north eastern Punjab. The Punjabi Muslims came from much the same area but extending further west. And then of course we had all sorts of odds and bits who came from places way out, miles away. Sometimes in the United Provinces. I can't think why or how they came in, but they were perfectly satisfactory. Our Punjabi Muslims tended to be Sunnis almost entirely. I had one Shiite, and he was a pain in the neck. But
what was wrong with him then? In what way was he a pain?
Well, I can remember early on, one of the first things I had to do was to build a tech headquarters for divisional headquarters, prior to Alamein. And I was over-conscientious, because we had to get the thing done quickly. We employed all three sections in series, which meant the work was going on all the time. And I, in a rash moment of conscientiousness, decided I had to be there all the time, and I worked myself into the ground, I can remember. Anyway, we were working away with compressors, because everything was rock there, and blasting these dugouts out. And so it was a fair amount of activity. And in the middle of all this, we were shelled. And so I ran round, seeing that everybody was undercover and all this. And I came, it was around about midnight. I came rushing round a vehicle, and there was a prostrate figure. And I was, oh God, wounded. And I rushed up to him. He was in the middle of his midnight prayer, which was, I felt like kicking him, I'm afraid.
He was too conscientious in his religious duties.
Yes. Yeah.
So you were in the training depot at Roorkee for about 6 months, and then you went off to Second Field Company. Where were they when you joined them?
Well, I was actually posted to 33 motorised company or something or other. And when I got to Egypt, I found they'd been wiped out. So I was glad I hadn't been earlier. And they were wiped out at Gazala. I was in the...
Were you sent out then as an individual reinforcement?
Yes, yes.
You were.
Yes.
So you'd had your 6 months, and presumably you'd learned the language and
yes,
got to know a bit about the structure and so on, and then you were posted to Egypt.
Yes.
Did you have any influence over that, or were you just told where you were going next?
Well, I remember asking for a posting at the end of the polo season. I didn't see much point in staying in Roorkee, and I was told I was A, too young, and B, too inexperienced, and all sorts of things against it, you see. And so, I don't know if it was deliberate, but if it wasn't, it was fortuitous. We used to have, in order to sort of keep us from total boredom, midnight picnics, which sounds a euphemism for something else, but I and two brothers, one was killed, Douglas Bird and, I forget the younger Bird, and I, and I think another chap who was still around, took four birds with us, and off we went with a load of drink and food, and we sat down by the side of the Ganges Canal and behaved ourselves. And it so happened that one of these girls, I think she was, I forget specifically my partner, but she was the wife of an officer who'd been posted overseas and was on her own. And the commandant had his eye on her. And I think he got wind of this. I was posted the next day. So in a way, I did have a hand in it. But
boudoir politics.
Yes, I suppose you might call it that. But no, I was going specifically to join this motorised, whatever it was. 33, I think the number was. But anyway, they got wiped out, so that was there. I stayed in a reinforcement depot in the Delta for a bit. And I was on my way to, I suppose it was a two-field company, on the train. And I met on the train, I was still a second lieutenant, a very nice lieutenant colonel, I forget who he was, nice bloke, And he knew we had to break our journey in Cairo. And I think I picked up my transport there or something like that. And we, was talking all about Cairo. I knew nothing about it at all. He said, well, go and have lunch in a very good place. This is very nice of him. And we went to a place in Sharia Maria Farida, I remember. And it was called Maxim's. And the food was excellent. It was really nice. And I remember, in the middle of all this, there was a commotion behind me. And the entrance door was behind me. And we were at a table for two. And the colonel was looking over my shoulder and said, good heavens, that can't be, can it? He was talking out loud. And I thought, I mustn't turn around. It looks rude, you see, so I kept my friend. He said, that must be General Alexander. But I thought he was in Burma, you see. It was General Alexander, and he'd come to have a decent meal. In the end, curiosity overcame politeness, and I turned round, and I met the glance of two eyes sort of boom, like this, and I turned round like video. That was my first meeting with Alexander, and I thought he was a good chap.
Did you meet him on other occasions?
He came on a formal visit to see us, and I can remember he chatted with Carol, had a quick word with him, and then he went right down the line, past me, and he got to the end. He said, right, where do we go? And I thought, I like that, that sounds good. He was doing the job. Yeah, he was fine. And I can remember going up in the back of a 3-ton lorry, as a humble second lieutenant, and we went through Alexandria, and as we passed the naval base, or the port, or whatever it was, the big sort of mole right the way around it, I saw two naval ships. And I knew a lot about the Navy, and I looked at these, and I thought, I don't understand this, I can't identify them. And they both had one large turret forward and one large turret aft, and I couldn't make that out at all. What they were, in fact, were the Queen Elizabeth and I think the Valiant, who were sitting on the bottom of the harbour because they'd just been attacked by Italian frogmen.
They'd been sunk.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they were not A and X turrets sticking out, but B and Y. And so I was interested to see what the Italians could do. It was a brilliant step, that.
Where were the Second Field Company when you joined them? When you got
we were sitting on Rawisett Ridge, which is about halfway, I suppose, between the sea and Katara Depression. Mm-hmm. And
what were they actually doing when you joined them? Were they holding the line, or were they in a...
Well, it was very hard for me to know. They didn't tell me what was happening, but there was a battle going on, I remember, because having climbed into my hole in the evening, I settled down to sleep. There was a weird noise going on outside. I'd never been in a battle before. But in fact, the Italians were shelling us with a 200-and-something millimetre gun, and when I came out of my little hole in the morning, I looked out, and the whole place was strewn with rounds that hadn't gone off. They'd sheared sort of spirally around the steel of the shell, and the TNT was lying all over. They hadn't detonated. And they were enormous, absolutely enormous. I thought, God, if one of those landed on me, I'd be absolutely dead. But that was the end of Alamein 1 and the beginning of Rawisett Ridge, I think.
Well, I mean, you arrived at the company location. What happened when you arrived? You said you got there in the back of a truck. How were you received, and what did they do with you?
Don't think there was anybody there. I rather forget. I didn't have any great reception or anything.
Well, who told you where your hole in the ground was?
I think one of the mess staff.
So it was mess steward showing you to your accommodation.
Yes, I think so, yes.
What was the ground like at the Rewisak Ridge?
I forget how high it is, but it's about 150 feet above the rest, I suppose. I suppose you could just see the sea from the top. I rather forget now. But it was all rock. There wasn't much. There was sand overlying it, but not deep sand.
What was your position, a fighting position, or was it just a shelter from the attacks?
Oh, it was a shelter. We were... I think we were behind brigade headquarters, I rather forget now, but we were about that level. And our main function was, and remained so for ages, we were just in charge of either laying mines or clearing mines or supervising they were still active. And it was about 99% anti-tank mines, anti-personnel mines, the clearing of them and the laying of them.
Who was in your specific unit, your subunit? Who did you get command of a section or a party?
Oh yes, I had Gwalis. Mm. So whatever it is, 65 to 75. Mm. I suppose yes, there was some training. We were training them in mine clearance, and every time a new enemy mine was found, I would get one of these things and give them a talk and show them how it worked and all this. And I remember there was an igniter, which I don't think they'd seen before. It was a German one, and it was called a Zugzug. Wait a minute. What was it? Anyway, it made a push-pull igniter. And so there I was turning up saying in Uru, which meant this that I have in my hand is called a Zugzug Zunda. And they didn't look phased at all. I admire the way they could absorb the whole thing in a foreign language, a foreign field and all this. They were marvellous. Nice chaps.
What sort of ages were they? Were they all young or were they a range?
Well, they're all old men to me.
All old men. How old were they?
I can remember taking kit parades. You see, they had everything, you see. And I'd go past a chap and he'd been missing, I don't know, a blanket or something. I said, why haven't you got three blankets? Oh, that was lost in the Battle of Gazala. So I went, oh, Christ, that puts me on my place. I didn't know. Well, I'd heard about the Battle of Gazala, but he was an old man, you see, and here was I, still wet behind the ears, nominally in charge.
Had they already been trained in mine laying and clearing? Were they?
Some degree, yes, yes. Mm. But then, you see, they'd originally come from East Africa because they went out to Sudan and then went in over the western border of Ethiopia and fought the Italians there. Because we were part of 5th Indian Division then. My brigade was 161 and remained so for the rest of my active service actually. Mm.
How would you go about detecting and clearing a minefield? What are the basic techniques?
Well, what we did then was just use bayonets, and they'd get a line of men and they'd go in a sort of crescent in front of them.
Just prodding the ground.
Yes, mm. And so there was no, well, there was overlap, there was no gap, you see. And then they'd inch forward. And I can remember, this was after Alamein, but I can remember standing behind a crowd of these chaps doing this. And suddenly a bloke said, Saab, Saab! And I thought, oh Christ, what's this, some awful sort of thing. And I came up there, and there, confronting this chap was, what do they call him, a sand viper, I think.
Oh.
Most evil-looking. It had, a horned viper, it was called, yes, it had horns behind its ears, and behind its eyes. Oh, it looked evil. They were poisonous, nasty things. And of course we had scorpions galore, so life wasn't all that easy. Yes, we were training them mainly in mine clearing. Mine laying, now that was quite a thing. I forget, I think it was, I'm proud to say, an English, an Indian Army officer who thought this one up. Because we'd done mine laying at Okchu, and it was entirely wide of the mark. We were standing up raw like a lot of blokes on a parade ground, which was ridiculous. But what this genius had worked out, because you had to record where the mines were, whether we each had the same or similar sets of signal cable with A, B, C, D, E, F, or however many rows of mines were, you see, and wherever there was, you would lay this thing out on a compass bearing, put them all at the same distance, interval between them, and then the chap who was laying the mines would walk along with the signal cable in his right hand and the mine in his left. When he came to a knot, he'd kneel down and dig a hole and put the mine in. And so when you got them all in, each line, or at the correct intervals, you could put it down on the record, so that when somebody had to come and clear it, they knew where each mine was. So we did that.
How deep a hole would you dig for the mine normally?
Well, depends the thickness of the mine, but we had some dreadful mines called EP Mark II. EP mean Egyptian pattern. And these were primitive to a degree. They were three concentric sort of soup plate things. And the top and the bottom were obvious to see. And then there was a thing that went in the middle. And in the middle one, there was a sleeve, vertical sleeve, with a plunger in it. And through the plunger was a shear pin. And you filled the bottom soup plate with gelignite. You then, through the bottom soup plate, horizontally, there was a tube about half an inch diameter, three quarters maybe. And into that, when you armed the thing, you pushed a wooden peg with a detonator and an ampule, so that when the pin in the vertical sleeve dropped to the level, it broke the ampule, set off the detonator, which set off the mine. They were dreadfully crude, they really were. And they were made by Egyptians, and the Egyptians, who weren't madly pro-British, every now and again would put a dumb one in, you see. And so that a lot of people blew their heads off, or their hands anyway, when they were arming these things.
Defective munitions.
Yeah. So the answer to this was to have another wooden peg, a certain length, and you've jammed this through the horizontal hole to see that the plunger wasn't down.
Yeah.
And then you put the peg in with the ampoule and the detonator. Oh, amazing. But as I say, we were in the dark ages as regards a lot of munitions. See, Germans, on the other hand, had these teller mines, which were beautifully made. God, they must have been expensive. And they had not only the a very sophisticated looking what do they call the thing? Primer, I suppose, that went in.